Well, good morning, and thank you very much for coming at this time of the morning to listen to my presentation. In the time available, it's not going to be possible for me to do anything other than just touch on some of the key issues that I thought was important in discussing public health planning and response for an event like the NATO Summit 2014. So I chose instead to structure my presentation to try and bring out some key points that hopefully all of you will find relevant to your situation, your role, if you have such a role, in disaster response and emergency preparedness. Now, by way of introduction, it's worth me just making a couple of remarks about the way civil emergencies are organised and delivered in the United Kingdom. We have a unified system across all four countries of the United Kingdom, defined under Parliamentary Act, the Civil Contingency Act 2004. And the Civil Contingency Act, like statutes enacted in many other parts of the world, was partly in response to global security threats that occurred at the beginning of the last decade, but was also an opportunity for us to tidy up legislation, some of which dated back nearly 130 years. The key points about the Civil Contingency Act 2004 is that it places responsibility for civil emergency planning and response in the United Kingdom on the Chief Constable, that is the most senior officer of each of the 43 police force areas in the United Kingdom. So the Chief Constable has overall responsibility for civil emergency preparedness and response. His legal duties include, among others, those set out on this slide, and he discharges his responsibility through resilience structures, which include the establishment of a local resilience forum in each police force area. The Chief Constable or his nominee chairs this, and all so-called Category 1 responders, the highest level responders, the Blue Light Services and others, are expected to be members of this group, and Public Health Wales is, as I'm the Health Emergency Preparedness Officer for Wales. So those are the basic structures. Now, the relevance for the NATO summit is that although, as I will say, NATO is a military alliance and we are talking about a military and security conference, overall command for the planning and the oversight of the emergency response rests with the force chief constable in the area where the event is held, in South Wales in this case. And that overall command extends to all military and intelligence assets that might also be deployed. So, very briefly, an introduction to the NATO summit. As I just said, the NATO is a military alliance, and at first glance, it may not be obvious why a public health doctor might have any interest in such an event. It was a big deal for us. In actual fact, this was the largest gathering of international leaders ever in the United Kingdom at a single event, including, for the first time ever, a serving US president visiting Wales. Of course, NATO has a reputation for attracting lots of protesters, and the key security challenge is to keep the guy in the top right of the screen away from the guy in the top left. And in order to discharge that, the police's primary responsibility is to put lots of security in place, including 12 miles of fencing around the conference facility, deploying military assets, as you can see there, as well as mobilising nearly 10,000 police. Now, the underlying premise of all of that is that to the police, intelligence and other agencies, 20,000 protesters brings to mind Chicago, Seattle, Lisbon, Strasbourg, and the list goes on. In other words, mayhem. From my point of view, from public health emergency preparedness, 20,000 protesters means inevitably they'll be corralled onto a campsite on a cold, wet, muddy field on the edge of town with no potable water, no sanitation, and likely populated by dubious food vendors, amongst others. There are, of course, considerations for the 5,000 delegates who attend, and there are also considerations for all the mobilised police, intelligence and military personnel. So these just highlight some of the numbers. This infographic was published in one of our newspapers a couple of days beforehand. The only thing I would draw to your attention is the number 168, which does not appear on this screen, but is in fact the magic number that the military and the police were concerned about, because that was the number of so-called designated, very highly protected individuals, individuals who had to have one-on-one armed protection, and therefore essentially defined the scope of the planning. From a public health point of view, we took a slightly different approach, and in fact we agreed that there were just two fundamental principles we needed to adhere to. The first of these was to put in place intensified public health surveillance, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. The key point I want to draw your attention to here is that this would be undertaken under intense public and political scrutiny. The event was being watched globally in real time. The second principle we adopted was enhanced business as usual with event-specific initiatives. Now, it has to be said, and I won't say which particular delegation, but it was the largest delegation, if that's a hint, wanted us to take certain actions which would effectively have shut down certain parts of our public service systems, which we politely declined. What we needed to do, of course, is to reassure them that we could function, albeit on an enhanced business as usual basis, without putting any additional threat on the event itself. And some of the ways we approached that was to agree to introduce enhanced media surveillance linked to military and intelligence. Daily situation reports, which we submitted to the Welsh Government and to the UK Cabinet Office in number 10, and organisational business continuity arrangements, which had to be enhanced. Now, in terms of the actual activities, there are three broad groups. Population health preparedness is set out here, with enhanced infectious disease and health surveillance. We did intensive exercising on outbreak response, including the possibility of a suspected Ebola case presenting in the emergency department of our VIP receiving hospital. You will, of course, recall that this coincided with the first case in the United States. And also other eventualities such as MERS-CoV being imported via a delegate. We did enhanced food inspections in all outlets within a 30-mile radius, and we also did 6 weeks of water testing in the conference facilities. In addition to all of that, we agreed a surveillance period with the UK government, which extended from the 25th of August to the 12th of September, albeit the event only took place on two of those days, as you can see in the middle. The first week and the last week, we did daily sit reps. On the week of the summit, except in the 2 days, we did twice daily sit reps, and on the actual summit days, 3 days sit reps. And from 8 a.m. on the Monday till 6 p.m. on the Friday, when POTUS finally left UK airspace, we effectively ran a 24/7 continuous command overseeing our response. The second major area was disaster and major incident response and preparedness. I won't go into too much details, but we exercised just about every scenario you could think of, CBRN, every variation. But the final exercise we undertook was the one that was agreed most likely. 10 days beforehand, we tested what would happen if a catering staff involved in the preparation of the state banquet to be held on the first night of the summit showed up for work and failed to declare that he'd been up all night with diarrhea and vomiting. The last area was health service preparedness. Now, having gently declined the request of one of our delegates to try and reduce the amount of activity going on as far as possible, what we had to do is put in place arrangements to ensure that routine business as usual within the National Health Service continued. We also had to assure that we could deliver for the needs of the delegates themselves, and so we turned the golf clubhouse into an enhanced primary care medical centre, including diagnostic capabilities. Fortunately, never required. So, from all of these, I just offer you three quick takeaways. The first is I would venture that there is no situation that doesn't have a legitimate public health impact. And in 25 years of public health practice, either in advance or definitely afterwards, you can almost always recognise where there could have been benefit from the application of public health principles to the planning and response. The second takeaway I would venture to you is that the unique contribution of public health to any event such as this, and this is a rather unique event nevertheless, is health surveillance. It's about collecting epidemiological data, analysing and making sense of it, turning it into usable information, and communicating it to the right people in the right format so that they can use it as appropriate but without distracting them from other activities. And then the third takeaway I would offer you is to be involved and fully participate. For the first 3 months, the police commanders had no idea why they kept showing up at these meetings. They eventually started to realise when we started to point out some of the potential hazards associated with an event like this. So involve yourself, be a serious player, and if you are a serious player, you gain trust, confidence and respect. And you need that because inevitably your plans never go according to plan. And under those circumstances, if they don't have confidence and respect and trust in you, they're not going to judge and assess any call you make under the circumstances with any credibility. Finally, I'd just like to acknowledge the core team that helped me with this. There were dozens of others involved, but these are the people who spent 7 months with me making sure that nothing went wrong. And in the case of three of them, spent an entire week in the police command centre with me overseeing the public health response. Thank you very much. Thank you.